Welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. My name is Brian Vitale. I'm your host. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
I would explode, Brian.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And Chao Minwu.
How's it going?
So yeah, a little programming note. Last night I was playing Dragon Age the Veilguard. And I noticed that my PC coolant temp was getting really, really warm. Like, it normally stays under 45 degrees at the most, but it was creeping up to like 53, 54, and my pump is only rated for 60. I believe I have a blockage in my all-in-one, so my pump is on its way out. I've ordered a new one, but it's not installed, so if I disappear, assume that I fried my computer. But yeah, I am running my computer as light as possible to try to prevent that, but...
That sounds like an excuse to get a new Ryzen CPU, since I know that people have been talking about how well it runs Guild Wars.
Yeah, but maybe I'll do a refresh in 2025, because I don't want to change out the whole motherboard right now. I'll try the new cooler to at least be able to play games over the Christmas holiday. My computer is running toasty right now, but I will be here as long as I am able. We are recording this about halfway through November. We're kind of finally on the tail end of all the big releases coming out, the last of which being probably one of the ones that have been circled on our calendar the longest, and that, of course, is Dragon Quest III HD 2D, the most recent remake for Dragon Quest III. I know this was revealed several years ago, went dark for a long time. There was a lot of rumors about whether it was going to be the first three games. That was mostly true, because we have 1 and 2 coming out next year. But for me, it was my first time playing Dragon Quest III. I know Adam has also revisited Dragon Quest III. I know we've had a lot of people, both followers of the site and contributors to the site, jumping into Dragon Quest III again, who have played it before or coming to it new. So that's what's going to be the focus of our podcast today, is talking about our time with that. We also have a Final Fantasy XIV patch. I know Josh went on some holiday spending and was messing with some new PC peripherals. We'll go into that. And then we'll talk about a few, we got a lot of dates for games coming out, squeezing in before the end of the year and then into early next year for early access releases and things like that. So we'll go into the discussion there. Adam, I'm going to lead this over to you to start out, because you have been putting a ton of work over the last month, and I don't think that's really exaggerating, getting a lot of features up on the site for Dragon Quest III HD 2D. And you're returning to the game. You have played it at least once before, probably more, but I'm not sure. So I'll let you kind of just start off the discussion here about your time with the HD 2D remake.
Yeah, so I've had a chance to play the remake as well, in addition to Brian. But our review on our site was actually done by Cullen, and he has played Dragon Quest III before. I'm not sure what version specifically, but this is not like a brand new experience for him. So he's also revisiting the game with the remake. He liked it a lot. He gave it a 9. Basically, his takeaway, which feels like generally this is how a lot of people felt in various reviews that I read, is that obviously it looks very different than how Dragon Quest used to look, but it still maintains its classic feel. But alongside that has a bunch of like usability, playability options in terms of like interface, tutorials, UI, and things like that. So I have played actually the mobile version of Dragon Quest III. So it came out on like for Android and iOS like 10 years ago or whenever it was. And that's actually the version I played.
I think I'm most familiar with the Super Nintendo version and maybe the Game Boy Color version.
Yeah, the Game Boy Color version I know is pretty popular here in the West, because I think that was like one of the first or biggest Game Boy games, you know.
Yeah,
a long time ago.
I started with as well.
Yeah, so that was when it was Dragon Warrior.
Yeah, I definitely never played the NES version though. That's mm-hmm. for me, right?
I know the Super Nintendo version is very popular also, or the Super Famicom version. So this game, the HD 2D is obviously the biggest difference, I would say. Visually, it looks quite different than how Dragon Quest, you know, tends to look. I mean, it's obviously still Dragon Quest, but in that HD 2D style. I know not everyone is a fan of how HD 2D looks in general. I think personally, Dragon Quest III HD 2D, it looks great, especially in like towns and dungeons. I was actually, when I was going through this game, I, as Brian said, I wrote up a bunch of guides and checklists and, you know, tips and things like that on our website. And I was kind of going through some other, you know, references to kind of make sure I wasn't, you know, I was accurate and whatnot. And seeing their screenshots of earlier versions of the game, it's like, oh, wow, it's, you almost don't remember how, like, constrained everything was back then. Much smaller, you don't see as much on the screen, your sprite takes up more room, and things like that. Here, it's the camera is pulled back quite a bit. You get to see quite a bit more of the town. It's a little bit more angled in a way, so you can see, you know, up close and far away. I know there are some settings that I changed right away for, like, depth of field, where... Just turn that off. Just turn off depth of field. It looks better when you
don't... Yeah, it's... we've had this discussion before. Subtle depth of field, I like, but... I think back to triangle strategy where they like blur out the other corner of the room you're in.
Yeah.
Like that is way. This one's like, oh, this building is very slightly in the foreground. We're just going to blur the hell out of it. Like, no, please. And yeah, it looks way better with it off, in my opinion.
Turn off depth of field in every game. You don't need it.
I do like it if it's done like perfectly well, but oftentimes it's not. I will say there are spots on the world map that in isolation look kind of bad to me. They look kind of like, there seems to be, like, to me, like a clash between the character sprites and the world map itself, but it's okay. Probably the second thing about this game that I think is most evident to people who have played earlier versions, it is easier than earlier versions of the game. Dragon Quest III, I know I played the mobile version, I know other versions are similar, is not an easy RPG. It's an RPG that really tests, like, your resource management and your battle strategies in terms of buffing, debuffing, healing, making sure you're covering all your bases there and whatnot. And going into a dungeon in other games, like, you're gonna have to be very careful about, like, your MP and HP and items and things like that. This game, not only is it just generally easier, which isn't too surprising, because I feel like almost whenever a game is remade or remastered, it's almost always made easier, not harder. But also, like, it's not just difficulty, but they throw a lot more money at you. The game throws a lot more items at you, equipment, weapons, and armor, and things like that. So it's just kind of, like, across the board, a lighter experience.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, I've been playing this on the Draconian difficulty, the hard difficulty equivalent. And even, like, the first, like, maybe 5 hours, I'm like, I don't remember it being this still easy. And I was like, it's definitely, like, even on the hard difficulty in this remake, it still feels easier than the original's difficulty, because of that, like, they constantly throw resources at you. But also, just, like, you know, you can find, like, shiny spots on the map, and they just generally, like, you get more items to, like, power up your stats. Like, in Dragon Quest III, like, you have these items called seeds, and you can, like, you know, seed of strength, seed of agility, and you can use these to kind of boost your stats permanently on any party member, and they just kind of throw it at you if you're just, like, generally exploring. Especially if you have a thief in your party and you're just, like, getting all the items, or, like, using your guide on the site that lists out all the items and everything. Like, if you just, like, generally just map out, like, how much they give you and go through that effort of exploring either yourself or with a guide, it's like, wow, they, like, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's just, like, it just kind of surprised me. I'm like, wow, this is kind of, because I'm thinking about, like, the recent release of Romantic Saga 2, where the classic difficulty in that, like, feels, like, either on par or at least a little bit harder than the original at time. So I just think back to that, because that was, like, the most recent remake that just came out.
So when I was playing through the game, I was playing through it on the normal mode. But to me, the first time in the game where I actually felt like, oh, I actually have to be, like, cognizant of my health and
stuff.
I have
to turn on my brain.
Yeah, I actually have to think in terms of my battles, was the Necrogond, which is one of the... probably roughly around the halfway point, maybe a little more. It's quite a bit into the game. So I'm not necessarily saying this is a bad thing. I liked playing through, like, the mobile version, which had, you know, it was like, I remember going through the pyramid dungeon in the mobile version, and it's kind of stressful in a good way for me, because you're going through that dungeon, and that dungeon's kind of special because you can't use magic, so you have to have other ways to heal. And otherwise, like, in this version, it was really no big deal. I guess, I don't know, Brian, if you felt similar, those 14 battle chests in that dungeon, I think around there I was maybe starting to run low on MP, but anyways, it's just easier. Which
it was one of those things where it was like, this is the first time I actually have to dip into my healing items, like right. level difficulty. Like, oh, I actually have to heal between battles.
You have to use these.
Like, so. Let me use my 60 medicinals herbs that I hadn't even need to look at until this point. So a difficulty spike, sure, more like a difficulty molehill.
Yeah.
and I agree, like around the Maw of the Necrogon, I also play it on normal. Like that's when I actually like, oh, I might actually need to go back to the inn and make sure I heal or actually use some like status effects or buffing. But even then it was like base level expectation, like what you're normally doing within the first 2 hours of any other RPG. And I didn't mind, like easy games sometimes can be cozy in a way. It'd be interesting to have played it on the Draconian, but I have seen lots of people, especially those that have experience with Dragon Quest III, I've seen people say like, what do you mean you can get two boomerangs and a whip like within the first like 30 minutes of the game?
That's not true.
And I'm like, oh yeah, that's true, because I remember early on you give two people boomerangs and regardless of how the enemies are grouped you can hit everyone, and usually like one or at worst two shot them, and I'm like, oh okay, that does kind of make things a little bit too easy. Well, you need a little friction in there.
I don't know how feasible this would have been, but that, like, this game really could have benefited from like some sort of like, I don't know, classic mode or something on the screen that's like, hey, we'll give you this like the same visual art style, but like we'll itemize it in a way and balance the stats in a way that was equivalent to the original experience, instead of just like being like, you know, instead of like kind of this like more updated, more new friendly version, like just kind of like a almost an antique mode, sort of like to compare and contrast for people, you know, to say like here's how it was in the original version, like here's how it was balanced. I don't know, but that's just me, because like for me, I just like I'm like second guessing so much of like myself, like I don't remember this, like of course I don't remember it being this easy, because it was never this easy, you know?
It's getting that Persona 3 reload experience. It's
yeah,
high, dude.
It's yeah.
Man, just imagine like in a couple of months, you're going to be having that like whole experience on steroids when you play Dragon Quest 2 HD 2D. And it's
that's
like
what I'm thinking. Like, what are you doing with 1 and 2 HD? Like, I was talking about this with friends. I was like, that if they keep it like this kind of the whole throwing items and money at you, like willy nilly, like this remake, it's like, I don't think you have to grind in DQ2 then, because that at the end of the day, like a lot of like frustrations with DQ2 came down to like kind of the balancing of that game, just fine tuning stats and everything, how it was like the difficulty curve and all that. So I don't think you really have to like go out of your way to like kind of mindlessly grind in DQ2 if they're gonna develop it along this same philosophy.
Yeah. So I should be clear that when I played through this remake, I kind of just assumed it would be easier, and it was almost like a foregone conclusion, and surprise, it is. I hope I'm not coming across as too critical. It's something I definitely think is, you know, very evident, but it's kind of, for me, like, it is what it is. And if you wanted to have, you know, if you want to have something, you know, a little bit more challenging, definitely try the Draconian mode, but even then that's not going to change how many items you're getting and whatnot, because the game throws a lot at you, like we said. The game, of course, like I mentioned earlier, in the original versions of the game, and actually a lot of Dragon Quest games have a similar philosophy, it's very light on, like, well, it is lighter on narrative. I mean, this game came out in 1988 originally, but in terms of, like, figuring out where to go and, like, how you actually move the game forward, you primarily used to do that by talking to NPCs, and they would basically kind of tell you, hey, there's, you know, there's a bandit stole the king's crown and he ran off to the northwest, and you're like, huh, maybe I should go northwest, and you don't know what's up there, but just an NPC in town basically tells you that. And that's actually referencing like a side quest earlier in the game around Vromaria. But in this version of the game, there's actually like objective markers that kind of tell you, you know, there's something to do up here on the map, and it literally will highlight it with a little circle. And whatnot. And later in the game, when you have to find the orbs, this is actually Dragon Quest 2-ish. In the original game, it's kind of just like you have a wide world to explore. Just go somewhere, do something, and figure it out. Talk to NPCs to get hints. Quite literally, like a lot of NPCs, their utility is to give you hints on where what is where. In this version of the game, when you go to when you get to that point, the world map that you can open in your menu will actually have like little highlighted spots, like there's something over here in this island up in the northeast part of the other world, and there's something over here on the west part of the world. You can turn those off.
That's what I was going to say. Like, to the game's credit, you can turn them off. And I believe Colin said it in his review, that's what he
did. Yeah, he did. Which I fully understand. Like, yeah. Part of that wanderlust is, you know, just wandering and kind of stumbling into something cool rather than just going where it tells you to go.
Yeah, it's like actual exploration of the world on your own terms. And yeah, you're actually like kind of have, and the cool thing about this, like when you're thinking about talking to NPCs and telling you where to go, there's like an actual feature in the game that like when you press options or start, like you actually can like remember like the last several conversations with NPCs that you had, right from like when you access like your menu. It's like, oh okay, what did the last like, you know, few NPCs tell me? It's like, oh yeah, that's right, they told me that about this tower in the northwest. And I thought that was a really cool feature. That like you'll probably be using like if you're turning off those waypoints.
My only problem was I think Brian is going to say the exact same thing. Is I would press start to open the menu and it's like,
yeah, yes,
you add this to your memory. Oh.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, I just
committed this memory. Yeah, I was born in the 80s. There will always be start and select to me. There will never be menu and options or whatever they are. Options and share.
Yeah. So that is the thing that's like kind of just throws you off is, yes, that start button is that feature, not to bring up your menu. I still do it when I'm playing. Yeah.
So I went into this game, my only Dragon Quest experience from a mainline game was Dragon Quest XI. So yeah, a latecomer to the series. And then I played like the Treasure spinoff and the Dark Prince spinoff. And then I'm like, all right, this is a great excuse to play Dragon Quest III. And I kind of went in with, I think, appropriately calibrated expectations. Like Dragon Quest XI came out in what, 2017? Dragon Quest III came out in 1988 before I was even born. So I kind of knew, like, don't expect even like Final Fantasy VI level of narrative. I'm not saying about quality, just level of how much to expect. And that's what I think newcomers or slightly younger players just need to be aware of, is that like it's like go out on this nebulous quest to be a hero, go pick up your party members from this party pal place. Like, they don't have any bespoke characterizations, there's not going to be that character driven story. They're really more like your toolkit, though. That's what the party members are. And we kind of had a very similar discussion like with Saga, because they say like, oh, that's this generation's thief or mage or whatever. So I don't want to beat that horse too much, because we've kind of talked about it in that frame before, but it still even kind of took me by surprise. Like, oh, I didn't realize going in that that's how this game's party system worked. And I'm 1000% okay with it, but I just think it could be a surprise for some people. And then, yeah, a lot of the story is kind of in the background. It's like events have already happened here, or the whatever the incident is in a certain place, whether it's these people are put to sleep or these people have been transformed into zombies or whatever, you go in and you find that the issue is already present. Oh, but if you go here, you might be able to help have the fairies help fix it. And I kept the marker on just for kind of for guiding purposes, because Adam and I worked on some guides for that. But it is very like low key. It's almost like a cartoon in terms of like a loosely connected narrative of events, but a lot of them you could see like, oh, on this episode we're going to go to the kidnapper's cave, you know, things like that. So it does feel a little bit bite-sized like that, which makes it a good fit for playing it on a Steam Deck or a Switch. But that I really enjoyed. I do think that the even just the act of dungeoning is pretty good. Like, I don't really have the vocabulary to describe it, but there's actually like exploration involved. Like, oh, I have multiple paths, let me try to make a mental map in my head about where to go. It avoids the Octopath problem of I have a tree branch and I just go to every dead end and pick up the chest and then follow the main path to the end. In most cases, like, I actually enjoy just exploration. Having just a classic world map is always nice. I think the addition of the secret spots is kind of fun. It gives you a reason to explore and like, what's that over there? What's behind that giant tree? What's in that boulder? And then you find a monster. We'll talk about those in a bit. Or extra gear. And it's always nice to kind of be able to keep those. The mini medals, of course, are a series staple. Turning those in and get, oh, now I have an even more powerful boomerang to keep the game's difficulty kind of pretty even keeled on that. So the only thing that I will say that about 50% of the way through the game, I am not against random battles, I'm usually okay with them. But I was kind of spamming that random battle reducing abilities that the thief has. And then I think the hero gets one too. And I wish it lasted longer. It reminded me almost like I was nostalgic for, like, you get that little random battle visual cue and I'm like, damn it. And then you just kill the enemies, put on your rappel. Another random battle shows up. So that it did frustrate me a little bit. But also, it could have been that if I was playing on a harder difficulty, I'd want to go into those to actually, like, train up or get new abilities or things like that. So it didn't disappoint me too much, but it was something that it did impact my experience to a small extent. But that, again, that's just kind of it's I guess the remake, I would say, seems faithful, though maybe coming from me who didn't play the original, that's a lot of hogwash. But Adam, how would you, like, judge the remake on that front?
Well, I want to bounce off what you said about, like, the story stuff, like the writing. I think you can kind of tell, like, this is an early example of, like, Hori's writing style, in that a lot of the narrative in Dragon Quest games, even more modern ones, like 11, which I know is several years old now, is more like vignette style, in terms of, like, there's a little story around this town or pair of towns that's sort of relatively isolated to the rest of the world, but, you know, is still compelling in a way, or is still meaningful, or is, you know, has something to do with maybe a larger theming or whatnot. You see that in a lot of Dragon Quest games. I think it came to, like, a peak in 7 in terms of how Hori does his writing. And even Dragon Quest 11, which has a more of a central through line for its writing and for its story and narrative, has, like, these individual, like, mini plots that happen, like, in the various towns and, you know, that have to do with the people and the places that you meet on your journey. And I feel like that's very indicative of, like, Hori's writing style. And Dragon Quest III is kind of you can kind of see the beginnings of that sort of structure and tone. Obviously, it's much simpler in 3, but that's kind of feeling that you were mentioning it on this episode or whatever. I think it does kind of carry through a lot of the games, even 5, which is also more centrally narrative driven.
The other thing I was talking about was just, like, exploration, random battles, the gameplay progression.
Yeah, so the addition of the secret spots and the shiny spots on the world map, it does feel like a little bit like, find the collectibles or whatever, make sure you get every one, which Dragon Quest games have always had with, like, the mini medals. If I were cynical, I'd be like, this is just a checklist, another checklist to fill out. But I do think you're right in that it does give you kind of that, you know, that when you're exploring the world map and you see, you know, like, a weird looking boulder or whatever, you know, there is that kind of little spark of joy when you're like, oh, I bet I'm going to get some cool stuff now. And I'm going to go to this boulder and see what's in there. Maybe there's an equipment. Maybe there's a friendly monster, like you said. And it's kind of cool to, you know, find those little spots. And some of them are actually kind of tricky to find. I remember when we got to the end of the game, we were trying to find them all. I'm like, oh, I didn't even see this one over here.
I think about, when they released this game after so many years, and, like, especially that specific mechanic of, like, adding these spots on, like, this, the big overworld map. When Dragon Quest III HD2D remake was first revealed, like, the very early footage that had that Golden Sun perspective, but they actually had, like, a clip of the world map, and it's, like, much, much, much more condensed, more compared to the NES version. While this one is more Super Nintendo styled after the Super Nintendo release, which is, like, a really big overworld map. And I'm thinking, like, I wonder if they had that system implementation in that early prototype, where they still were conceptualizing it as a remake of the NES version rather than the Super Nintendo. At least in terms of the overworld map, because in that very first trailer, when they get to the overworld map, it's pretty condensed. Mm-hmm. And, like, I was like, man, I kind of wish we got it. I kind of interested in, like, what that would have looked like too. Not to say that what we got was bad, but just thinking, like, wow, that's what the early prototypes of this were, like, really interesting. I wonder, like, what happened during development to influence them to go in this direction of more the Super Nintendo version rather than the original Nintendo version.
Well, we talked about this before also in the lead up to the release, when this game was kind of, you know, in radio silence after its announcement. It was originally, like, its developer changed after its announcement. I want to say like its original developer on its YouTube channel is like Amata KK or something.
Oh, which, yeah, that's right. I forgot about this.
I don't even remember what else they've done, if anything. So for those who aren't aware, it's obviously a Square Enix game, but Square Enix works with external partners for a lot of their titles, especially their HD2D stuff. The game is ultimately made by Art Inc., right? Which is who made Triangle Strategy, right? So
Freedom Wars.
That's why the depth of field is so
there. I'm not right. I'm not wrong, right? I'm not getting like Art Inc. and Acquire mixed up, right?
It's Art Inc.
No. And that's Triangle Strategy was also Art Inc., making sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Too many HD2D developers.
yeah, it is. Okay. So in terms of new content, the Monster Wrangler class is the most, you know, headlining thing. And Monster Wrangler class is very good, or very efficient, very useful, arguably broken. I want to see how people come away or take what their takeaway is from the Monster Wrangler once they get further in the game. If
they
the Monster
kinda,
Wrangler is broken,
they kind of fall off a little bit, like as you get progress through Draconian. That like that they're still good, but I wouldn't say they're crazy. I could see them being really good at like the easy and normal for sure. I think that there's that progression. I mean, of course, depending on personality, I think can struggle to keep up at like later in Draconian.
So the thing about Monster Wranglers, here's how they work generally. So there's, besides the hero in the original version of the game, there's like 7 different classes you can pick from at Patty's Parting Place, or whatever it's called in other versions. And then there's an 8th class, which is the Sage, which is a little bit different, which you can only get later. So the Monster Wrangler is like the 9th class that you can have. And while I do gain some skills as they level up, what you can do, one of the new additions in Dragon Quest III HD2D, is around the world you can find friendly monsters. And what a friendly monster is, it's quite literally just like a monster is just sitting in town somewhere, like in the corner of town or in a dungeon or in a secret spot. And you just walk up to them and they're basically like, hey, I'm a friendly monster, let me join you. And then they get shunted off to a Monty's little monster pen or whatever. And there's 121 of these throughout the game, I think, if I counted right. And these monsters are used in the monster arenas throughout the world. And then also, the more monsters you get, the Monster Wrangler in your party will gain more abilities. Now, you can get these friendly monsters without a Monster Wrangler, but it's actually a lot more... there's more like mechanics there, because they might run away because they smell you, or they might run away because they hear you, or they might run away because they see you. And so you either have to like put on an item to hide your scent, or do the spell to turn yourself invisible, or the Padfoot ability to turn yourself quiet. But if you have a Monster Wrangler in your party, they disjoin. That's kind of one of the advantages to Monster Wrangler. Now, the abilities that you get when you for collecting these monsters, there's two of them that come to mind that are like very useful, or actually three. You get a healing ability that allows you to heal your entire party. It doesn't heal a lot, but some. And I actually felt like that was quite useful in the Pyramid Dungeon. The reason being is you cannot use magic in the Pyramid Dungeon, so you have to find other ways to heal. So here's another way to heal. But really, the abilities that are much more useful, there's one called Monster Pylon, which is basically, it's kind of a Looney Tunes-ish little cloud of scuffle smoke that comes across the screen. That's basically your monsters attacking the enemies that you're facing. And the more monsters you have, the stronger it is. That does pretty consistent damage throughout the game, and it doesn't cost a lot to do. And then there's also another ability called Wild Side that you get, which allows you to act twice per turn. And that combination of Wild Side and Monster Pylon for your Monster Wranglers, it's not like the most damaging attacks in the game, but it's very consistent. Almost every boss fight, my Monster Wrangler was just doing hundreds of damage every turn just by doing Monster Pile on every turn after a Wild Side. So my point is that if you're playing this game and you're wondering, should I try out the Monster Wrangler class? I would say, one, they make collecting the friendly monsters almost trivial. If you know what they are, you don't have to worry about your scent or sound or anything. And two, they are useful in battle. Maybe not broken, depending, but they're very useful. Like they're not going to be dragging you down for sure.
Yeah, for sure. That it's okay. Definitely a well thought out class. Like, mm-hmm. It's definitely would have been easy to like include something and throw off like everything, but I think the addition of the Monster Wrangler like really was a really thoughtful thing of them to do.
Yeah, and the Monster Arenas end up being a pretty small aspect of everything, all things considered. I think there's only like 10 of them throughout the game. But they're just another way, like, if you've been collecting monsters, you should be able to clear them as you find them in different cities. And they give you money and they give you items and weapons. So it's just like another way that the game kind of hands you good gear for everything. And it functions like the Dragon Quest Monster series, where you can kind of assign general tactics, like focus on attacking, focus on healing, but then the monsters kind of just act on their own. So it's kind of like a fun little dip into that sort of gameplay style, but it ends up being pretty minor thing. Like it doesn't take hours to complete through.
Well, what else is there to say? I didn't know this going in, but if you're the type of person who just wants to play through this game, you don't want to, you know, you don't want any friction. You just want to, maybe you've already played it a bunch and you just kind of want to see what this game's about. Or you just want to just see the story as kind of, you know, relatively simple as it is. The Draki quest mode is actually God mode. You cannot lose. I didn't know that going in. Draki quest mode, you cannot die.
Yeah
you get stuck at 1 HP.
Yeah. That's cool. But yeah, it's just... it makes you really curious, the more I play of this, it makes you really curious what they'll do for the other remakes, the 1 and 2. See how those shape up. It's such an interesting prospect, you know, because those games were really, they were products of their time. So a lot of them feels antiquated even more so than what Dragon Quest 3 presents. So I'm really wondering, like, oh, what are we going to do for them? Not to say that they're bad games, but they're definitely... you can feel their age when you go back to them today.
Now, stepping away from the game itself and more about like the reception to the game, it's like one of the best performing Square Enix single player games on Steam in terms of concurrency, like ever.
Oh wow!
Yeah, its peak is 43,000.
That's pretty good for Square on Steam.
I need to check. Like, I think in the last several years, the highest concurrency was I think Nier Replicant's remaster, which was okay. let me check what that was. I think that was like 27,000. Let me check. 28,000. So Dragon Quest, obviously Dragon Quest 3 is huge in Japan, like one of the biggest games ever in Japan. Like
I'm really interested in what the Famitsu sales are for this game in Japan. Obviously, they won't take it to count digital, which obviously a substantial portion, but nonetheless, very interested.
Yeah, and I remember seeing somewhere like the regional breakdown on Steam for like who was buying this game, and it was like more than 50% Japan.
The site that's been doing that, the methodology for it is a bit flawed, because they're assuming that Japanese users don't review as much on Steam, but. Oh. The thing is that like people have even been saying that, yeah, there's probably more Japanese players than like English players, but it's still like around 30,000 during like peak USA hours when Japan would be asleep. So very clearly, it's not just Japan that's buying it on PC. It's actually pretty healthy, at least in the US. Apparently Europe, it's not been selling too great on PC over there based off the Steam numbers, like during peak European hours, but definitely obviously Japan's the biggest region for it overall, but on PC, like the US and I guess like Canada and whatnot aren't exactly, it's not like it's not selling.
Yeah, it's not lopsided, but it's, that wasn't my point. And I'm not saying that you were saying it was my point, but it was like, it's Dragon Quest III is a huge game in Japan. Like anytime that game is re-released or any, you know, related to it, it's, you know, people are taking off work or not going to school or whatever.
Not really related, but I saw some people say like Farming Simulator 25 just released and has 100,000 concurrent. And it's like, how many Germans are on that playing Farming Simulator or whatever?
I can't make fun of them for that. I'm looking forward to the new Flight Sim. Day one VR support. I'm gonna have fun.
If I ever had infinite time or could freeze time, I've always wanted to try to get into like Euro Truck Sim. If I
enjoy watching streams of them.
If I could squeeze it in.
Yeah, whenever I see a stream, it's like it seems like this person's always having a good time playing this game. Awesome.
But Dragon Quest III is doing really well, it seems. I kind of figured it would do well, but if you told me it's the best performing game from Square Enix, like in terms of concurrency on Steam, at least in the last many years, like I would not have predicted that.
So, and I assume that's probably like the best that obviously Dragon Quest III outside of Japan has ever done, because you know when this game came out in the West in the early days, you know, it was still relatively unknown in the West.
You know what, Adam? I'm actually going to disagree. I'm going to disagree with you on I wouldn't have expected it, because back in the day when the Western version of Dragon Quest XI was day and date with PC, it did really, really well on PC. It was like 11,000 concurrent, which back then was a huge number. I think if anything, it just shows that like why like Square Enix is finally like getting rid of their exclusivity bullshit, because it just ham-fists like how well their games can do on PC, which is probably the biggest market worldwide for RPGs at this point.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, I guess from my memory, when it came to like which Dragon Quest finally broke into the West, in my memory, that's like Dragon Quest 8 for the PS3. I don't know if it is, but
Wasn't it that the Dragon Quest 8?
Dragon Quest 8 had a demo for Final Fantasy 12.
Yes. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot it had the demo. Oh, yeah.
Everyone bought it, and we're like, yeah, that's just pretty good.
that much energy is always too strong.
And also, that was in the era when like Dragon Ball Z had exploded by then, and we're like, oh, this game looks like Dragon Ball Z.
That's right, yeah.
Even the main character's hair turned Super Saiyan.
He's Goku. He's just basically Goku. That's cool, though. I mean, it's one hell of, like, they did a great job with the remake. I really like everything I'm seeing in terms of just presentation. It's such a lovely... It feels like a timeless game, almost. It's like when you're going back to it, it's like, oh, yeah, that fuzzy Dragon Quest... old Dragon Quest feeling. It's always a fun time.
And otherwise, in terms of new content, there's a few more scenes that show Ortega, who is your main character's like hero father, and his journey. Because in previous versions, his journey was just kind of in the background. Like, he was just a hero who went off and kind of disappeared. Here you get to see just a few, not many, but a few little snippets of his journey. And I don't think they're too like intrusive, or they feel, you know, discordant with the rest of the game. These scenes aren't too long. I think they're a fine addition, just kind of to bolster that component of the writing just a little bit. For those who care, there is a new post-game dungeon. I have sort of mixed feelings on that, but it's there for those who love to get to the very, very end of these games. There is a new post-game dungeon.
And it's kind of smart because it interfaces with, like, it's not all just dungeoning and battling, though there is a lot of that, but there's like, to get past this, you need to have the reward for having most of the mini medals. To get past this, you have to have collected most of the monsters. To get past this, you should have done most of the monster arenas. So it's kind of a nice way to be like completionist about the game if you're really enjoying it and really wanting to see like extract everything out. So I think in that sense it's well done. It in terms of like there's obviously really nothing narrative to it, and it's fine.
It's funny seeing like your characters like battle sprites in battle, like before you're about to attack the enemy, because like, it does the zoom into the first person to show your attacks and everything. But like when you're hero, for example, is like using anything but a sword, like say like a boomerang or a whip. Like the hero still has the sword sheath in their back, but is using another weapon instead of the sword. So it's like it's just a really funny sprite decision that I kind of really dig. It's very charming.
I actually kind of really like that the sprites change based on which weapon you have equipped, and I assume this is true to the other versions of the game. But you have a lot of options in terms of modifying your sprite, like your class, your gender, type A or type B as represented in the game, hair color, and then like four different outfits depending on your other combination.
The appearance customization is new in this remake, I believe. I don't think they allowed that or they had that at previous releases. I think that like changing your hair color and all that stuff. I don't think you can do that in previous.
Yeah, you can't change the hero's hair until later, but you can change all your party members' hair. But yeah, it's like, I always thought it was cool. Like, oh yeah, my thief has a whip now, and it, when they're in battle, because before you input, and I believe all Dragon Quest games are like this, but I'm not sure. But it's kind of like round based. Like you input all your actions, and then everything plays out in a round. So during the round, of course, it's first person, which is very classic. Though, yeah, the original showing of the game suggested that it might not be like that, but they ended up going back to that. Which after like 20 minutes playing the game, I was completely used to it. Like I didn't even think about it. The first person just made sense. I know there was some discussion about the ending, which I don't know how much detail we want to get into here, but Dragon Quest III obviously originally released third, but now it's releasing before 1 and 2 HD. People had some strong feelings about that. It'd be interesting to see once 1 and 2 HD are out, what the recommended like play order becomes, whether it should be 1, 2, 3 or 3, 1, 2.
Yeah, I mean, there are some 30-year-old or older spoilers to this, I guess.
Talk about the twist? It's like...
To me, as soon as this game was announced, this is sort of a foregone conclusion that this is going to have to work differently, if at all, in terms of like how the, you know, it's just a different experience if you play this first or if you play Dragon Quest 1 or 2 first. It's kind of just inevitably. So, yeah, like Brian said, once Dragon Quest 1 and 2 come out, we'll kind of see, I don't really expect much, but like, how do they handle its connection to 3? And then, you know, 5 years from now, if people say like, hey, I want to play those remakes, which ones do I play first? We'll see what opinions there are in terms of, actually, you should play 1 and 2 first and then 3, even though those remakes came out later. We'll have to see.
You play Dragon Quest 11 first, then 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dragon Quest 11 is really great. You should play that.
Phenomenal game.
I like it a lot. We've given it 3 10s on the site. Once for PlayStation, one PC, and once for Switch, I think. Yeah. So. But yeah, I think it kind of covers it for touching all the components of Dragon Quest III HD 2D. Obviously, a really cozy game. Seems like, by all accounts, relatively faithful to the originals, though potentially a little bit tuned down in terms of friction difficulty. Monster Wrangler seems pretty naturally incorporated into the rest of the game. It doesn't feel like too off the wall. I enjoyed it as a first time player of the game. Like, I was able to put myself in the mindset of this is a remake of a game from the 80s. And even then, like, as a contemporary game, I enjoyed it plenty. I thought that Cullen's review was pretty holistic as well. So obviously Cullen's not representing his thoughts on the podcast here, but he did write his thoughts on the game up on the site, rpgsite.net. So go ahead and give that a read. And then of course, Adam primarily and me with some assistants have been doing a lot of guides on the site. So like, if you are really completionist, you want to know how all the post game works, some class suggestions, how personality works, you want to find all the mini medals or monsters. And we even have a checklist fishbone walkthrough. So if you just want to walk through just to say, hey, here are all the enemies in the area, here's all the mini medals in the area, similar to our ones like for Final Fantasy 1 through 6, Adam primarily and me with a few touch-ups, we have that up on the site as well. So we've been trying to cover this game quite a lot because I know we have a lot of people who have really, you know, fond memories of this game or really strong feelings about it. And we know, obviously, clearly a lot of people are jumping in as it released this week. So we have all those up on the site for those that want that extra guidance. For the next game we're talking about, we previewed this a couple weeks ago, but it just released in the last week, I believe. I'm going to hand the microphone off to two other people of the podcast, James and Chow, to talk about the most recent Final Fantasy release. I'm assuming Chow started it, but I'm not sure. I know James has. So this is, I believe, James, the 7.1 update. So we kind of previewed it a few weeks ago, but now that it's released, just a little window here to talk about the first update to Final Fantasy 14 Dawn Trail.
Yeah, so the new Final Fantasy 14 patch dropped, and kind of one of the things I was talking about earlier when Dawn Trail was new was that realistically, the earlier patches, because of the way that 14's patch cycle works, aren't going to be anything major. And that's pretty much the case here. We got the first Alliance Raid in the FF11 crossover Alliance Raid series, which has been very good, very well received. It's going to be curious how it like scales later into the expansion when people's like average item level goes up. That might make it retroactively not as good because it'll make some of the fights like way more trivial. But as of right now, it's really good. People are liking it. I think it's probably in like top three alliance raids in the game. But again, we'll see how things go in the future. There's a new main story. It's fine. I think a lot of people, it's really tough to talk about Dontro's story because there's so much like drama about it. I would say that 7.1 does a lot of work to kind of flesh out some characters that were in Dontro's story, and they were kind of just there. There wasn't really any sort of explanation for them, and it was just not really fleshed out. Like, they were just kind of, it almost felt shoehorned. Now they feel a lot better. Like, for example, there's this one, like, child character in Dontro who is part of the latter half of the story that just kind of exists. It's like not really much explanation for it. And then here it's like, okay, we're delving into their backstory a bit. The new dungeon's good. The new extreme trial is really good. I'm glad that they didn't mess up the expansion's third extreme trial, two expansions in a row, because the last expansion's EX3 was not good. This one is definitely way better and actually has some interesting mechanics that makes me excited to see what they might be doing with later fights, because it's like, oh, this is the most you've played around with the game mechanics and what you can do in fights in a while. And it's like, oh, that's really promising for the future. And that's basically it. There was a few things that were added to treasure dungeons, but the treasure dungeons themselves are the same. We didn't get the second treasure dungeon yet. There's a new like allied society quest line, which is for helping level up combat jobs. If you haven't already like leveled all your jobs to max. And there is going to be the new ultimate raid, not this Tuesday, but next Tuesday. And
didn't they rework some of the old dungeons too? I heard there's like the graphic blow up is pretty insane.
Okay, yeah. So some of the Realm Reborn zones, they did also do some graphical updates, but they also broke a few things. I don't know if they fixed it yet, but the two world bosses in Dontro, at least a couple of days ago, I was hearing that they just weren't spawning like ever since maintenance. And there was also some issues with some areas of Thanalan where they broke water, where the water is still there, but you don't have any sort of like interaction with it and you can't fish in it, which is really a big deal because one of the more sicko things you can do in 14 is like do time locked fish to try and get the fishing achievements. And so if that doesn't get fixed soon, if it hasn't already been fixed, that could have been a problem if like a window for a rare fish in that area of Thanalan popped up and it's like, well, you can't get it because all the water in this area of Thanalan does not exist. But that's
as someone from the outside looking in, I saw something about either new or re-recorded or updated voice acting, but yes. I don't know the context.
Yes. So there was like an infamous line in the final story trial of Dontro that was just poorly directed. And I think, yeah, I'm just going to say it right here. I don't care if it was like the Japanese side of things, like not giving the voice director like enough information to go off of, or if it was the voice director making the mistake. It is like actually kind of disgusting how obvious it is that like Senna Breyer got completely fucked over, because it wasn't just her voice lines like in Dontro that were like objectively not really great. Like even like returning actors, like there's some Ishtola lines or some Grahatia lines or some Asinian lines that aren't good, better than Senna. But Senna hasn't been playing her character for very long, whereas everyone else has. So even if the voice direction is off, they generally know what to do by this point, but she's gotten so much hate. And a lot of it's been like transphobia and that fucking sucks, but also a lot of it's been down to the fact that some of her voice lines are just not good, especially that one that they replaced in the final story trial. And it's not really her fault. It's the fact that the voice direction this expansion has been noticeably a downgrade. So hopefully hopefully after like all the complaints that people had, that they'll make sure going forward they don't have that mistake again. But it's unfortunate that it had to be fixed in the first place.
Is the replacement an improvement then?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, cool.
The old one was like, listen to me. Like, what?
It did not sound good. It did not sound good. And I hope now that it's been fixed, people can admit that the voice direction was an issue for that line without being like, oh, are you just hating on her because of transphobia? It's like, no, she's a fine voice actress. It's literally just the voice direction. This expansion has not been good. Not just her.
Voice direction is tricky because, like, when it's done well, you don't really, you know, it's hard to credit. You credit the voice actors for doing a great job. But then when it's poor, it's like, well, clearly the voice actor didn't know the context, and then they get the blame. It's a tricky thing. And it's good on Square Enix for admitting to and identifying a mistake and taking the opportunity to fix it and correct it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, hopefully good luck on the upcoming Ultimate Raid for Dawntrail. And we'll see where the story goes as the post-patches for Dawn Trail continue into the next year.
Look, I'm not doing ultimate raiding, but James, you gotta beat this ultimate raid for me. You gotta see what Eden's all about. Please do it. Don't drop it.
I might have asked this before, but is the ultimate raid like a souped-up version of a previous extreme, or is it brand new?
So it's the way that ultimate raids work is that they're usually on a TikTok schedule where it's like they'll have an ultimate raid that's based off of MSQ for an expansion, like main story. And then they'll have an ultimate raid that's based off of a raid series from an expansion. So, for example, the ultimate raid in Shadowbringers was based off of the Alexander raids, which was in Heavensward. And then the first ultimate raid in Endwalker was based off of the Heavensward MSQ. This one's a bit different because, like, if we were going off of that, we would have had a Stormblood MSQ one this time around because the last one was the Stormblood raids. But this time we're actually getting the Shadowbringer raids represented in an ultimate raid. And what that usually entails is that they'll take encounters from that raid series, soup up some mechanics and remix things. And it'll be, instead of it being 12 fights like before, it'll be, okay, we're going to take mechanics from most of these fights, soup them up, make them harder, gonna make it way trickier to like do. And it's like, oh, by the way, this is like one 20 minute fight and you have to do like manage everything in one go. So that's how ultimate raids work.
Cool.
And usually like most like statics spent like about 6 months practicing to clear it. Obviously there's like world first could do it within like 2 weeks or even less. But the average player base will take about 6 months to clear these, doing this like kind of like in a regular schedule, like playing 2 to 4 hours each day. So yeah. Pretty intense.
Yeah, there you like from my experience when I was doing DSR, which I didn't end up clearing it, but I got to like the final phase. So I got pretty far. I can clear it. I just need to find another group to do that with eventually. But it's, you really spend a lot of time in those fights. Like, I think I put like 300 hours into DSR just like grinding it out. And it's interesting. It's like nothing else in gaming. It's definitely a commitment. Definitely a commitment. I might be a dumbass and try and do it on Party Finder this time since I did this raid tier on Party Finder. That might be interesting. Stay tuned. but yeah. That's one thing I do want to say. Like I said, this patch isn't really exciting. And there's been a lot of people that have been talking about the fact that unless you're a raider, there's not really much reason to stick around for this patch. And that's just kind of true because, like, obviously there's the ultimate raid, there's a new extreme trial, but there's also, like, at the end of next month, there's going to be a new 24-man, like, chaotic alliance raid, which is also going to be high end content. And they've said that they're not sure if they're going to do more. They're going to do more. If you go on the duty list right now and go into high end duties, you can see they made a whole new icon for it. So there's going to be more chaotic alliance raids down the road. But for 7.1, if you're a raider, you're feasting. But if you're not a raider, there's just not really anything for you to do besides MSQ at this point.
And it's floating around in my head because next week, Guild Wars is actually adding its first raid in like 5 years. And it's similar sentiment where it's they're not adding a new story map. There might be a few new story instances, but people are expecting it to be pretty light. But there's a little bit of hesitation, like, do they even remember how to make raids? Will it be any good? But there's a little similar kind of trepidation there. But they are trying something new where the standard raids are 10-man. People have complained that those have been too easy, so they're introducing a legendary challenge mode, which I would assume is like elite level difficulty. Extreme, not elite. And then they're adding like a 50-man mode, which would be like an alliance level difficulty. So they're trying this new like tiering thing, which is new. They haven't done it in 5 years. We don't know if it's going to be any good. So I know it's a small fish in a big pond for that one, but I'm curious to see if they'll do anything compelling in that sense. So maybe I'll report on that next week as well. And then we have a little window here. Josh, Storytime Corner. Josh, you can talk about your time deciding to look into new gaming peripherals that took 10 months to ship, or 10,000 years to ship.
10,000 years to ship.
There you go.
Yeah, so throughout this week, I've been kind of just dilly-dallying a bit. Like, I played through all the Famicom Detective Club remakes, and plus the new Emeo game. I just
did. How'd you like Emeo?
Back-to-back. It was interesting. I think it was really interesting to see like what a modern Falcom Detective Club game would
Falcom
look like.
Famicom.
Yeah, I'm Famicom.
What'd you think about the epilogue thing?
The epilogue is weird. Because Emeo is about this investigating this bizarre murder case where I think middle schooler kid was found dead, and they had like a paper bag over their head with a smiley face on it. So it kind of leads you down into some interesting tangents over like, is this connected like the urban myth called the smiley man or not? And I won't spoil the end or the epilogue or anything, but like by the end of that base game, before like the credits, like when the credits roll, there's still like some substantial parts about it that like you don't really know. It feels like a case that like you understood 60% of by the end of it, because you're like, what the fuck happened? And like that remaining 40% is filled in with this epilogue. And like this epilogue, it has like the standard kind of investigation, like talking to people phase to it. And then it has like a big, like almost like anime episode at the end of it to fill in, like to really kind of dig deep into like fill you in on like what context you're missing. And like, I think it's very enlightening and like interesting that like, you know, the details that like you learn from it. I don't know if I agree with the structure that the way they presented it in. I feel like I wished I kind of got filled in on this during the adventure part of it, like in the main game. Because doing it like in an epilogue, like almost post-mortem format is like, I don't know. It still feels weird to be bizarre. I don't know if I agree with it, but I think the adventure, the mystery itself is interesting. I think some of the revelations are kind of underwhelming and borderline stupid.
Yeah.
But
I will say though that I kind of felt that way about like all the Famicom Detective Club games. I think it's like, at least for me, it's undeniable that Emeo is the best one, probably.
Well, the first game is too obtuse to like get through. It's such a pain in the ass trying to like get to the next story destination,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The girl who stands behind is all right, but it's just like, I don't know.
The main twist is like, oh, that was it? It's like, yeah, so I could see why you would say it's kind of underwhelming, but the game is solid overall, right?
Yeah.
I started to think about it, but yeah, I think it was definitely the strongest game, but I do like some of the review, the presentation bits better, the girl who stands behind over Abby at some part.
Yeah.
But
one thing that's really neat. One thing that's really neat about that, like epilogue thing, is I got the Japanese limited edition, and it comes with like actually some like of the storyboard stuff for the OVA, and actually has like some of the like notes for, hey, this is how we want it to be. It's like really, really cool.
Okay, that's awesome. Yeah, yeah, production stuff like that is always nice to see. I think it's really like the production value on that like when you're playing back to back you can see like all the subtle.
It's gotta be the most expensive like adventure game ever made just for that alone.
It's also just really funny seeing like really minor things like, oh, you could now access the settings menu on the main menu before you begin the playthrough now, instead of the first two where you couldn't do that. or even subtle things like, you know, like in every video game ever, it feels like when you have like a menu, you can access the bottom of the menu by just scrolling up from the top, right? And then it'll go immediately down to the bottom. In the first two, even in the remakes, you couldn't do that. You had to always go from top to bottom if you wanted to reach the later options. While in MU, you can finally just go to the scroll to the top of the menu, and then it'll go loop back down to the bottom. And it's like, oh, that changes everything. That's crazy. So it's just really funny stuff like that. But overall, I think it was a funny adventure to have, like just playing these from back to back to back.
We all take menu wraparound for granted.
I know, we do. We really do. I'm just glad to, like, you know, I got to play them, I got to fully experience them, and I really hope they make more of these Famicom Detective Club games, like just new ones. I think.
Also, what do you think of, was it in the second game, what do you think of hearing, like, is it the first game, where you hear, like, Sugita right in the beginning, and you're like, it's like, why would you waste such an important voice actor for this guy?
I mean, I can't. It's definitely like there's some really high, crazy profile say you.
But you know, it's like when you do it for this guy, it's like, you know, he's obviously hiding something, right?
Well, oh, it's... Who knows? But yeah, it's really, really, really cool to see. But yeah, as I did those like in the span of several days. But even like a little bit before that, the latest Taiko no Tatsujin game came out on other platforms besides the Switch. It got in the PlayStation, Xbox, and Steam. So I was like, okay, well, you know, I've been waiting for a Taiko game on Steam for like the longest time. So I was like, I'm just gonna fucking do it. I got the new Taiko game. I got the subscription pass that allows you to like. The base game has like 75 to 76 songs, and then if you get the setlist edition, you'll get like maybe 15 or 20 more songs from it. But if you get the subscription pass, that like were more that like more licensed stuff is added along with, you know, just a shitload of other songs. It expands that catalog of like maybe, you know, 85 to 90 ish if you get like the expensive edition, up to like over 800 songs. You know, and then since it's a subscription pass, you can buy it like in 1 month and 3 month bundles, depending on how long you want that sub. So I got that 3 month pass, and I was like, you know, I started messing around with it for a few hours. I was playing a little bit of controller, a little bit of keyboard, and I'm like, you know, Taiko is
just
great.
Doesn't feel right.
It just doesn't feel right. Yeah, and like I need a Taiko drum controller, you know, because I play like whenever I go to arcades that has a Taiko machine, I get on them and I just have the time of my life, because playing these games on a drum controller is like just like an experience like no other. So,
yep,
here we go. Time to go see what the modern day selection of Taiko drums look like.
Because remember when your best choice was, there was this guide that was like, okay, so disassemble your Taiko controller and do this like 15-step modding process. That's not an exaggeration.
Yeah.
That's not an exaggeration. And it's like, now it'll work 95% of the time instead of 80% of the time.
Yeah, so like the Horika controllers that like was bundled with the Switch, and I think it's coming to the other platforms. Like it's small. The Maibachi, the drumsticks, don't really like. It kind of feels cheap.
Like at a minimum, you have to get your own like Maibachi, which is it's not that expensive. You can get them for like what, $15?
I like the ones that I got. It was discounted, so it was like about $15, but it was discounted down to $8 since I got it with the one that I got. So, but I was looking around, I was like, okay, how much do I want to spend? Because usually That's kind of the law of the land of Taiko drum controllers. Yeah.
Well,
usually let me just first overview. It feels like the more you spend, the better that you'll get.
Let me establish something for people listening that are not familiar with rhythm games, especially rhythm games on PC. At minimum, you're going to be spending like $200 on a controller. That is just how it works on PC. That is how it works.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, I don't want the Hori controller because like that's $70, but you're not gonna have a good time with it unless you go the route of opening it up.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, the one that's like the most arcade accurate is like the Taiko Force, and that's like $700. I'm like, okay, I'm not gonna go that crazy. I really like Taiko. I'm not that crazy about Taiko. So, and I was looking at like the Taiko Roller and other options, like the IINE Pro Max, and I'm like, these are still kind of expensive. I don't want to spend that. Like, I don't want to spend like $300-$400 on it.
If I'm gonna spend that much on a rhythm game controller, I'm gonna actually get really into Sound Vortex. Gonna really get into Sound Vortex. That's what I would do.
Yeah, because those controllers are fucking expensive for Sound Vortex.
Yeah. I love Sound Vortex, and I love whenever I can go to a round one to play it. But man, if I had a Sound Vortex controller and I could play the PC download version, oh man, it would be over. It would be over.
So I was looking at it, and then one of the newest ones that got into the market, like maybe I want to say this like barely like a year old, maybe even just like a few months old now, is the Rhythmagica TDC-10. So this is not as big as an arcade Taiko controller in the arcades, but it's not as small as the Hori ones. It's a kind of I don't know what's the best way to describe the size of this. It's like.
Is it like 30% bigger, 40% bigger?
I'd say about 35 to 40% bigger than a Hori drum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, which that's a comfortable size. Yeah. Honestly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I was like, okay. So it was out of stock on Amazon. So I was like, fuck. So I went to their site and I was like, okay, it's on sale. Get a pair of Maibachi as well. So like this already comes with Maibachi, but I like Maibachi the drumsticks a little bit thinner and
yeah. I don't like the thick ones. I like the thin ones.
Yeah. So I got a pair of those. So overall, like the grand total of this was like $204 with this drum and the Maibachi.
And how much was it if it wasn't on sale? 300?
Yeah, I was like that, yeah.
Yeah.
So around that. So I was like, okay. So I was eagerly anticipating this, and as someone mentioned earlier on the podcast, it felt like 10,000 years because I was like eyeing every day when I got up. I'm like, okay, what does UPS shipping say about my delivery? It took like forever to get out of China over to like to update it to like Alaska. You know, I was like, oh, we're so back. It's on its way. Actually, there's signs of life. So I got it in yesterday, and I got to play with it already for like several hours, about 3 to 4 hours. With it, setting it up is super simple. Like the stand, like it's just like it's like a two parts of a stand, but you can connect the hinges to it and put down a bolt to keep them in place. Fits it right in snugly with the drum controller, and then you download like a mobile app. That you pair with it'll automatically find the drum if you have it hooked up already, and then you just update the firmware. And then the really nice thing, I really like about this, the TDC-10 is the mobile app lets you like really fine tune the sensitivity, like even like the left don, the right don, the left and right ka, like you can actually like have different sensitivity settings per zone separately from them. Over as well as like an overall threshold slider as well. So when I was first playing, I was like, man, the left don feels a little bit unresponsive and not really picking up some of the lighter taps. But I was able to like just adjust that on the app to like, hey, turn up the sensitivity of this zone specifically. And it's like, and then it worked perfectly after I saved the settings. And now I'm just like kind of getting some muscle memory back and getting used to playing on a drum again. And it's just been, it's so fun, man. Like, it's really hard to, like, explain to people who've never played, like, Taiko no Tatsujin on a drum controller that, like, it's just, like, an experience like no other, because you really get, like, an appreciation of, like, how these games are made and fine-tuned for that, for drums specifically.
Like, especially, rolling notes and whatnot.
Yeah, like, rolling notes is, like, for people who don't know rolling, like, it's like when you tap on the drum, you use the vibration of you tapping to basically do like a double or triple tap, depending on how good you are.
And then that could roll. Okay, so here's the best way to explain it to people that are slightly less into the weeds on this stuff. if you heard about the whole thing with the Tetris thing earlier this year, where people are like, oh, modern Tetris players, they roll the back of the controller to get like faster inputs. That's basically the same principle.
Yeah. So it's just, oh man, I already feel like it's like, okay, like that $200 was well worth it, because like I just have like a shitload of songs and like and a lot of practice to like really go through to start clearing out harder difficulties.
And I'm assuming this works on stuff like TGA Player and like Open Taiko and stuff too, right?
Yeah, because you're just mapping like the keys to it. But also like you can also map to like any form of input you want on the mobile app. So on the mobile app, you can actually specify, hey, do you want it to register on as a PC via keyboard? Do you want it to register as like you're plugging it into a Switch, or you're register it as a controller for like the PlayStation? So it's like you're just mapping it to different. You can map it to different devices, and then when you're on PC, like it's mapped towards certain keys on the keyboard. So you can work off of that, and so it's really, really versatile on just like what registers does it as an input, pretty much. So it's also like the really funny thing is like if navigating Taiko no Tatsujin on the PC with this thing on is like I still can't navigate the menu with the drum, so I still have to use the keyboard. But you can actually use the mobile app to navigate that menu too, because it has like a virtual controller mapping of either a keyboard or controller inputs depending on your how you set it up, and then you can actually just navigate that in-game menu with the mobile app virtual map controller thing. It's kind of funny, but my setup, it's very easy to read to access my keyboard and just pick a song right away.
Not related at all, but remember that era of like the Xbox companion app or whatever when you'd have it on your phone
or
your console or whatever?
Yeah. So this is, you know, I figure I'm gonna treat myself a little. You know, it's been kind of heavy lately, so I wanna bring some new element into my life that I've always wanted to do, but I never took the dive on. And I was like, you know what, I really wanna start just kind of learning how to like play like Taiko more consistently on a drum. Decided to do it.
Last year, my girlfriend and I actually got that for the Switch, and mm-hmm. It's weird to explain. Like the track list is like mm-hmm. It's a little bit of everything. It just seems like random. Like everything from like here's Eye of the Tiger and here's Sha La La, the Dragon Ball like opening theme, just like and everything in between, like it just
you have like so classical random music, you have pop music, like they have like the Star Wars theme, and you have the Pirates of the Caribbean theme.
I will say that still I think my favorite Taiko track list, including DLC. I own all the DLC for Taiko V version on the Vita that cost me over $100. There's a lot of really good tracks on the Vita version of Taiko that I, as far as I know, haven't been available anywhere else. And then there's also like custom like note maps that people have made that you can install. So that's still like usually my go-to because I've gotten used to using like the buttons and D-pad, even though it fucking sucks for some harder note maps. But it's funny, like some rhythm games, and Taiko is definitely one of them. It's like you get to a certain difficulty, like 8 stars, and then anything above that is just exponentially harder, and it's really funny.
Don't pass off those stars as nothing. They're like the difference between like 5 to 6 stars could fucking kill you.
But it's
one of those things like you'll get better at the more that you do. It's like muscle memory almost. Like
yeah,
it's a process that happens gradually over time as long as you kind of do it a little bit each day.
Yeah.
So that's my little silly fun story.
Now look forward to when I talk about all of the Microsoft Flight Sim 2024 stuff I will have gone through this time next week.
Are you getting a flight stick or do you already have a flight stick?
I have a flight stick. I actually have this like Thrustmaster flight stick I got at a pawn shop like over a decade ago and it still works. So.
I know. That's what I always hear from people. It's like, yeah, like my flight stick, I don't have any of the new stuff. I have like one that I had like in the shed like so many years ago. It's still rocking. Yeah. Like I had one for which Star Wars game was it? PC. It was
so fuck yeah, Star Wars.
The one that everyone played with the flight stick.
On. Yeah, the first like yay Star Wars game that anyone had anything good to say about it. I'm trying to remember what it was.
Those were the days. Fuck.
Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
But I completely understand where you're coming from when it comes to weird niche peripherals, especially with rhythm games, because I love rhythm games. Don't ask how much money I've spent on DJ Max DLC. I own all the music packs.
Yeah, so that's kind of the weird, I would say double-edged sword, but like, that's kind of the reason why I was almost thankful that there was like a subscription pass for Tyco, because
at least for DJ Max, the music packs go on sale frequently, so as long as you're not buying them at launch, it's like you can usually get them for like 75% off like during a Steam sale, and there's like bundle deals and whatnot too. But man, just it's always the same story with rhythm games. If you're a rhythm gamer, you are suffering, and people don't really realize just how bad it is.
Yeah, I mean, like the situation, like it improves, but it's like at such a snail's pace. But like, it's like at least you're like, taking like you know one inch forward, you know. But it's usually just law of the land. The more you spend, the better of an experience you will have.
It's just like with GPUs. The more you spend, the more you save. I also spent a lot of money this week. I got a new CPU.
Yeah.
I figured for Monster Hunter, I don't want to leave anything to chance, and also with possible tariffs, I was like, I'll just get it now.
Yeah,
I'll just get it now.
Yeah, but if anyone's looking for a new like CPU out there for gaming, apparently that new 9800 or
9800 X 3D, which is the fascinating thing about that is that retroactively we now know why Zen 5 was kind of a disappointment. AMD fucked up by having the same IO die. It's had a massive impact on like the server chips, like the performance in IPC was better, like a significant upgrade. And people are like, why are the consumer chips having issues? And because of the 3D V-cache, it's not having to deal with the IO die as much. So even though the clock speed is lower than the 9700X, before you overclock it anyways, it is performing like 20% better in like production applications, which would make no sense otherwise. So the only thing that makes sense is that Zen 5 sucked because of the IO die, and because the 3D V-cache means it doesn't have to deal with it as much. We're now seeing how well it should have performed in an ideal scenario. So hopefully next time around they swap out the IO die and we actually see another like 20% uplift, because it's like, surprise, you're also getting the Zen 5 uplift at the same time. Interesting stuff.
So basically 9800 X3D, good for gaming if you're looking for an upgrade on our potentially, you know, looking for a new CPU.
At the beginning of this podcast, I was doing a Dawn Trail hunt train in Dawn Trail. And obviously, since it's a Saturday, that's about as packed as it's going to be. And it was averaging above 100 FPS. If you play 14, if you do hunt trains, you know how insane that is. I don't have to explain it to you.
If my cooler thing doesn't work, I might be poking you and be like, hey, suggestion for like motherboard for this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm always okay kind of going into a tangent and talking about peripherals of of role-playing games, or not role-playing games, rhythm games, fighting games. I don't know, things like that are fun to talk about and kind of get a a look in every once in a while. In terms of news this week, we don't have a lot. Like I said, kind of teed up earlier, we have a kind of like a lot of dates squaring into place into December. We do have a handful of game announcements, but these are kind of announcements that are pretty far out. Some of them don't even have trailers attached, but we'll kind of go through these and then we'll go through the rest of the updates for upcoming late winter, early spring releases into next year. This one is kind of a follow-up from something we talked about last week. We talked about that Aqua Plus was having their 30th anniversary event. They announced a new title in the Utuaro Romano series, seemingly related to Monochrome Mobius in that kind of in the prequel character and locations. But they've also revealed that they're working on a brand new RPG project. Details are pretty light. Right now it's under the working title of Project Kizuna. And it's being helmed by people who previously worked on I Am Setsuna with project director Kenjo Uchibori. So basically, they're working on creating a new RPG IP for Aqua Plus. So cool and interesting stuff that they're branching out and just kind of announcing that it's in the works.
I'm really glad because I was worried for a moment thereafter, like how bad Monochrome Mobius did, that they were just going to stick to their mobile game that's apparently been like keeping them afloat for the last like 4 years.
Hey, I Am Setsuna is back. I'm curious to see like where. Hopefully, there's not another mobile game. Hopefully, there's actually like a new like full RPG experience. That, like, but it's so hard to know. Like, they only have like one screenshot of this Project Kizuna. It's like it seems to be like based on like the ocean sea theme style RPG. It had like some sort of like naval vehicle with a cannon out of it sticking out of it. Might be cool, but it's hard to say. I think the bigger thing that I think Chao and I cared about was the other announcement that came out with this that isn't an RPG, but they finally showed off the visuals for the Two Heart remake, and it being like a 3D visual novel.
It looks like they managed to like stick the art style pretty well. Like it looks good, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, so I'm interested to see more of that in motion because I think they like you said, I think they stayed somewhat like pretty faithful to like the original in terms of like what the characters are doing in their posing. But obviously the potential of 3D models is like better facial animation, better expressions, more seamless, more kind of natural in terms of like when you're interacting with them in a video game. So I'm really curious. And once again, hopefully that and the Tokimeki Memorial remake get, you know, localizations. That'd be great.
I'm sure if nothing else, assuming that Valve doesn't fuck them over, Shiravun will do this, will do a translation for the PC version of this.
Hopefully. I would love, yeah. That'd
be great. I mean, as far as I can tell, like Aqua Plus is their like one of their breads and butter. So they're doing the Utuaro Romano Zan PC port, which I know for a fact the reason they're doing that is that the main guy, Rob, over at Shiravun really likes the Zan games. Because I remember when Zan 2 came out and I was like talking about it, he was like right there also sharing his impressions. So it's like he's a sicko for that stuff. So I know for sure, if nothing else, he's trying to get them to do that. And I'm pretty sure considering they do a bunch of VNs and dating stuff.
Well, look, I'm praying every single day, somewhere like a little speck in the back of my brain is like, please Shiravun announce the Western release of White Album 2 already. Please,
we know it's coming. It's just that's a big one. So it takes a while to translate.
I know.
It's going to happen. Assuming that Valve doesn't fuck them over, it's going to happen.
Man.
I just hate that for visual novels, you always have to say, assuming that Valve doesn't fuck them over, because that is the thing, especially considering it's a high school VN.
Yeah. Whenever Valve, someone at Valve hears that, it's like, oh boy, I can't wait to strike it down. Not a great situation.
Yeah, it would be great. It would be great if Aqua Plus would let them release their games on GOG, so the other option wouldn't just be the terrible fucking DMM games launcher with the worst DRM imaginable. But
you also had like one of the Dungeon Travelers, or I forget if it was one or two, like it's stuck like Jorin as well.
No, so Dungeon Travelers 1's remake is available on Steam. But Dungeon Travelers 2 and 2-2, which, reminder, 2 released physically on Vita. You could have bought it at a Walmart. And then obviously 2-2 was also physically on Vita in Japan. So it's like, there's no good reason why these games shouldn't be on Steam, even if they are, if you think they're tasteless. They've been rated.
I just kind of wish it was like, yeah, because Jordan does not have a great DRM. Frustrating. So like, I hope those
It works like a Windows license where it's like after you've like activated on 5 PCs, you can't activate it anymore. You have to buy another fucking copy.
Yeah, that's not good.
I know it's not Sherbin's fault. I know that they're limited in what they can do. Yeah. It just... with so many VNs and stuff also released on GOG these days, it's like I can't help but look at the fact that there's like full Metal Demon Muramasa on GOG. It's like, man, wouldn't it be great if you could just get the Dungeon Travelers games on there? Wouldn't it be great?
I wonder what's really just holding them up on that.
You would think that GOG would actually be a good market for that, because DRPGs, blobbers, are for those old like retro sickos, and GOG used to be goodoldgames.com. You feel like that would be a good environment to release it in. I don't know. But yeah, whatever.
Another announcement from this week that is a little bit wrapping back around to Project Kizuna. Basically, like as we've kind of detailed, no announcements of a release window, planned platforms, free to play or not. So kind of all speculation at this point. One game that was also announced this week from Netmarble. This is a game that is targeting PC and mobile devices, is Mongol Star Dive. Apparently, this is a follow-up to Netmarble's action RPG Monster Taming, which is a mobile game released about 10 years ago. I don't have any history or experience with either of these, but they did release a handful of trailers for this new title. To me, it seems very much in the vein of Genshin Impact, Honkai Star Rail. I don't know if the title is also kind of pulling from that or not. But a title that's now in development under Netmarble for an unspecified release window.
It's kind of the... I guess, you know, ongoing theme of like, because G-Star in Korea recently happened this week, and, you know, that shows off, like, you know, some of the upcoming games developed by Korean studios. And, you know, that's kind of like a big theme about, like, you know, ever since Genshin Impact released, its influence continues to be felt, you know, several years later with, like, all these new and upcoming games, you know, very much influenced by what MiHoYo put out several years ago, because that was so successful, made a monumental shift in just like kind of the acceptability, mainstream acceptability of just a gacha game. Not only that model, but also just like the scope of what it could be, having this big open world and switching between characters and action RPG and all that sort of stuff. Just like on a production level, that was not really seen as much before, and definitely broke the mainstream in a way that no other game did previously in that regard. So, you know, we just kind of see a lot of those, like a lot of the new footage of upcoming games at G-Star. Definitely a good chunk of them was like, yep, this looks like Genshin. All right. The upcoming like Seven Deadly Sins game, the one that's like from that anime and manga IP, you know, that's also very Genshin, like very big open world, switching between characters and all that sort of stuff.
And the press release from Netmarble goes into some detail. There's two protagonists, Cloud and Verna. There's some taming elements with the mascot character who is... it's like a blobby cat called Nyanners, Nyanner, like Nyan Cat.
Is that like the VTuber? Is that Nyanners? I thought that was a VTuber.
Maybe it might be.
No, yeah. I think it's not the VTuber. It's just the same name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a kawaii blob cat.
Okay. I wasn't aware.
They talk about three member parties. It's they kind of really focus in that this is a story based game in the in the press release, and then of course a large number of screenshots showing characters, environments, battles, things like that. So check that out on the site if you're interested. But yeah, two trailers as well showing. Well, one's a trailer, one's more of a commercial PV.
You know what else is kind of, you know, definitely influenced by Genshin? This next news story that you're about to hit up.
Oh, okay. So this one is from is it Timi? T-I-M-I? Timi Studio Group. They are partnering with Capcom to announce Monster Hunter Outlanders, a new open world mobile title. So obviously the current title is Monster Hunter Now, which released was at late 2022. But this one seems like it's to, I have not played Monster Hunter Now, but with the announcement trailer from Monster Hunter Outlanders, open world, fully detailed Monster Hunter game. But talk about the free-to-play elements, Josh.
Yeah, so what distinguishes this from differently from like Monster Hunter Now, because you know there's already an ongoing Monster Hunter mobile game. Monster Hunter Now is more like instance monster fight. Like you go into a hunt and you're already confronted with a monster right away. So you're really just focusing on like taking down the monster, like using like you know the touch controls to operate like your character. But there's no like open zone exploration element to Monster Hunter Now. That more interfaces with, like the real world GPS stuff like Pokemon Go, where like you know like you're walking and then you find like an item nearby. So you go pick it up because you're like you're physically in real life by that item that's depicted in the game. That's kind of more the quote unquote exploration side of Monster Hunter Now, is interfacing with that GPS element. In Monster Hunter Outlanders, it's much more akin to what you'd see like in a console title, where you're actually going into the world itself and exploring around to go fight a monster. Now, as you mentioned, and as depicted, like you know, in the announcement, it's an open world game, so it's not even like instance zones anymore. It's just like a big open world, much like you know, like what Wilds is going for. So we didn't really know the nature of this game because, like you know, we had like gameplay footage, but like there was like no UI, no really elaboration until like a producer's message started coming out shortly after its announcement. And this, it seems like in this game, you're not creating your own character. There's actually like distinct characters in there, like that have that come with their own armor set and their own weapon, like that are all just, you know, these are the characters you play as. So being a free to play title, more likely than not, you're probably rolling for characters in this game to use as playable characters. Now, in terms of like how they're gonna do this system and like what different rarities, or if it's gonna be like you have to also roll for weapons too, we don't exactly know the specifics yet. But all we know for sure is like they're definitely leaning towards like you're probably gonna have to roll for characters in this game. There's also like elements like they're like some part of the footage is like you building like your own house in this game as well for some reason. But other than that, there's not really much known in terms of like, you know, we saw some remaining or returning monsters like Anjanath, the Puke Puke, and we also saw that like at least one of the footage or like scenes depicted was like your Palico or a Palico was confronting a monster as well, which is, you know, not the first time in the series that there was like, you know, you could play a Palico before in previous Monster Hunter titles. So we'll see. I don't know. Like, the only announcement for iOS and Android devices. I don't know if they're going to release a separate PC client for it or a PC version for it or anything like that. I would like, if they're going to do that, like, I would like to see that, too, because the current footage that they've provided, like, actual real-time footage, it doesn't perform well. And like, already, it's like, oh, man, this already looks... the performance of it already looks
it's dire. Like if that's what you're showing, it's like, okay, so is that the best you're gonna get? Is that what you're gonna get on like a fucking iPhone 15 Pro or something, or 16 Pro or something? It's like,
yeah. They also showed like there's like hang gliders as well, which is, you know, I'm just saying, you know, Genshin had hang gliders to go explore its open world. We don't know if it's like, if it's like Genshin, where in the sense that like you're rolling for multiple characters to switch between them during battle, or if it's like you roll for one and you're only playing that character for that hunt and you can't switch out or anything like that.
I saw on the Reddit someone joking like having to roll so that I can beat the elemental check on a Latreon because I don't have good enough gear or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Man.
TV Group has done things for you, so like, I think they were behind Pokemon Unite, But I don't know exactly
which, what as else far as I know, there's that's still pretty being pretty well supported, yeah. And like yeah. It still gets new Pokemons, or at least yes. Earlier this year it did. So
yeah, that still seems pretty healthy from what we can tell. So we'll see how this shakes out. Yeah. But it's not unexpected, you know. I mean, the Monster, like, if anything, Capcom is, you know, very happy to kind of just license things out, to whether it's collaborations or like spin-off projects. So, you know, if they think this is worth doing, then go for it. It's like, I think the announcement of it was like just kind of like a weird at first, because I was like, isn't there already a mobile Monster Hunter game? It's like, oh, it's kind of more of a traditional one rather than the GPS one. So I don't know. I mean, hopefully it's neat, but once again, it's kind of like a weird proposition of like, hey, you wanna play Monster Hunter? Go roll your characters in Monster Hunter. It's like, that's weird, I guess.
Yeah, the Monster Hunter Pokemon Go like, and then the Monster Hunter Genshin like.
You know, this game's gonna be like, if they're gonna like really get. If depending on like what Capcom will allow them to do, you know, there's gonna be something like, hey, there's a raid up banner for Hinoa or the other Shrine Maiden sister from Rise, because there's a Rise collaboration going on, and these character banners are only gonna be up for like, I don't know, 2 weeks or something. Go get them now. It's like,
and then it'll have the Wilds tie-in. With the characters in February.
Yeah, go roll for an Alma Navigator.
Well, I guess they didn't announce a release date, so we don't know if this is going to come out before Rise or not. Or sorry, yeah. Wilds,
yeah. So, I mean, hopefully it's neat, I guess, but I don't know. I'm kind of 50-50. So.
We have a couple small updates for some upcoming games. Earlier this year, we talked about a remaster for the Fate, capital F-A-T-E, dungeon RPGs coming to PC. The developer Gamigo has announced that those remasters will be also coming to console. We didn't get any other specific details about release date or release window, but basically that remaster project will be also coming to console. The games as they exist are already on Steam, so the remasters will exist alongside them once they do release. So just a small update there. We got kind of a press release style update for Like a Dragon Pirate Yakuza in Hawaii. I feel like this could have been a trailer, but as far as I know, it was just a press release. Just talking a little bit about combat styles. Some of this was already gleaned from the announcement trailers or shown off back when the game was announced. I don't want to read this line by line, but just high level, Majima will have his normal Mad Dog style, which is like fist and knife, and then the Sea Dog style, which he uses cutlasses. It does talk about how there is ship combat. You do have like some sort of mechanic where you assign crew members to different positions on the ship, and then ship appearance. So don't know how involved that's going to be, but it seems like the exact sort of thing that RGG would put into a Yakuza game is a whole super in-depth ship management feature.
We'll have to see where it is on the spectrum. I don't know what the spectrum looks like, but I assume at one part of the spectrum is going to be Skull and Bones, and at some other part of it is going to be East 10, and Pirate Yakuza in Hawaii is going to fit in somewhere in it.
Yeah. it's one of those things where the concept is always fun. Like the idea of manning a ship and crewing it and decking it out and arming it on paper, that always seems fun, but yeah, Yeast kind of fell flat. I haven't played Black Flag, but apparently it was done really well there, and Skull and Bones, I haven't really heard one way or the other. The last thing they talk about here is they call it Dark Instruments, I believe. Instruments, where I guess Majima can like summon sharks and apes and
that things sounds to, like, awesome
help him in battle. So it's like, yeah, why not? I mean, I guess they already have the pound mates from the recent games where they summon all sorts of like lobsters and stuff to help out. So why not? But yeah, we kind of have the details and all the screenshots for all of this up on the site if you're interested.
I would love to play a violin to summon a hungry man eating shark and play a guitar to call upon a massive ape that unleashes immense uppercuts upon enemies. That sounds like a fun time.
And then this one's a little bit more of a catalog thing, but Apple has announced that a lot of Square Enix titles will be coming to Apple Arcade starting in December. In December, Final Fantasy IV, the 3D remake, and then the After Years 3D version will be launching on Apple Arcade. I guess I haven't played anything on Apple Arcade since Fantasian, but they're calling these plus titles, which I guess means like premium title.
Yeah, basically any like App Store game that gets added to Apple Arcade, and usually the plus signifies that it's either, okay, it's a free-to-play game that had ads, it doesn't have ads now, or it also could mean that it sometimes, if it was a premium game, like you had to pay for, if it's on Apple Arcade, it'll just be plus, even if it's no different from like the version you could buy. It's just, why do I know this?
I mean, it's
funny hearing this, like, if it's plus, because like to me and Chao, it's like, oh, like a fighting game move is plus. That's a good move then, you know. Just we're just thinking of frame data instead of like what this actually means in Apple Arcade.
Yeah,
safe. I'm blocked.
Apple Arcade game is plus on block.
Well, I'm picking it up then. Sounds awesome.
So yeah, those 3D remakes are coming in December, and then are starting next year in January. It's Trials of Mana, and then the Final Fantasy Pixel Remaster, as far as I can tell, just Final Fantasy 1, so not the whole set. So if it does well, I'm assuming the rest will come through. But yeah, I guess this just aligns with Square Enix's new strategy. I guess we were thinking, you know, more along the lines of console, PC, simultaneous release, but also getting their mobile legacy titles on mobile subscription services as well. So not a bad move, all said and done.
I should plug in my Apple TV again, because there is surprisingly some pretty good games that are just stuck on Apple Arcade. Did you know that there's like a really neat Bomberman game that's basically also like an album?
No.
Yeah, it's Amazing Bomberman. Like all the stages are also like themed to these music tracks, and there's like a city pop Bomberman song. It's like really interesting.
Okay,
man, city. Let me see.
I think you had mentioned it back when we were talking about, what was it, Kunitsugami? What was it, one game?
Yeah, not Kunitsugami. It's It was World of Demons, which I did a review for, because I played through it and I was like, this is going to be literally lost media, so I should like do something for it.
Are we good to move into dates? Oh, you got it. Okay.
I'm just going to post in. Don't have to listen to this, but just so you know what I'm talking about.
That for your listeners, we are going to see what this looks like. Well, we'll go into dates here. Announced this week, a new demo is available for Shin Megami Tensei V Vengeance. Obviously, the games came out this summer, so the demo is coming out after the game. But it does, for those who haven't jumped yet into Shin Megami Tensei V, have the extended demo that carries through into the purchase release once you jump into it. So always good to have.
This is a cool thing. I mean, I think it's weird that it's only available on Steam and PS5, but...
Oh, I didn't catch that. Good catch.
Yeah. But it's, you know, obviously it's available on, like, all platforms, all modern platforms beyond those. And it does support save data transfer into the full game. And it actually lets you try, like, both the original storyline, the Canon of Creation, and then the new Canon of Vengeance storyline that was added for the Vengeance release. And you know, they also highlight in the trailer that, like, you know, we already reported on it recently, but they had like a patch update that added a new demon, new quest to recruit that demon, and like demon navigators and stuff like that. So it's kind of like just like a neat like thing, like, hey, you know, give curious PS5 and Steam players a shot. I wonder if that demo will come out on other platforms eventually, but this is kind of like a weird platform selection.
It just seems good for catalog sales, just to say, hey, we have this on Steam and on PlayStation Store, and if you're interested in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you can try it out on a demo. Your progress will carry over. It just seems smart to do. Also available now on Steam Early Access is Beastie Ball, which is a indie volleyball RPG. Let's see. Launched a few days ago at the time of recording, or literally yesterday at the time of recording, the English version of Heaven Burns Red Josh, I forget if this is one of the ones you were, if you had kind of dabbled in or not.
Yeah, I'll talk more about it next week because I think it's a definitely heavy story based game, despite being a free to play mobile game. It's co-developed by Right Flyer Studios and Key. So, and Junwade Maeda from Key is both writing the scenario and composing it, and he hasn't done that since 2007 with the release of Little Busters on that. So, like, I'm still working my way through, like, it. It has a lot of content from the get-go. I really like the localization so far of it. It's there's a lot of charm to it, which is very emblematic of Key storylines, where they have, like, each of the characters that you meet in their visual novels are kind of quirky, a bit silly, but, you know, that there's going to be some tragic event that probably happens that it's all leading up to, but you get attached to the characters because they're so eccentric out there and very energetic, sometimes over the top, and there's a certain energy to it that it kind of just cheers you up because it's like these characters are so larger than life at times. So I'll talk more about it next week, but yeah, so far from what I've played, I've already played like, I feel like 5 to 6 hours, and I've not even done chapter one.
Like, well, a lot in.
Yeah,
I thought this main character is more of a menace than the Honkai Star Rail.
She's a lot.
There's like Ruka's a lot of like hilarious options.
Yeah, Ruka is a funny character for sure. So yeah, we'll the Chow and I will talk about it more next week. And yeah, it's a blast so far. I'm enjoying it a lot.
Announced back in September was the I believe it was a PlayStation streaming event. I forget what they called it. State of Play, that's it. Stellar Blade was going to get a Nier Automata DLC crossover. We finally have a date for that. It'll be releasing on November 20th, along with an update that adds a full featured photo mode.
Yeah, this is I think this is paid DLC. So like the Nier Automata stuff is something you have to pay for additionally. Obviously, the photo mode.
Was it free?
I believe it's paid. Let me go check real fast. But
I could have sworn it was free. But
last I heard, it was paid. But yeah, from the official Stellar Blade account on Twitter/X, I'll link it on the voice channel on Discord. But they say that they have confirmed that the Nier DLC is paid, while the rest of the photo mode and costume updates are free. So, in this Nier Automata collab DLC with Stellar Blade, a meal shop will show up, and you can buy with in-game currency the like collaboration items. So, like, you can dress up as 2B with, like, her standard attire, but then there's, like, more, you know, sexier attires, costumes that you can unlock for her. A2 as well you can dress up as A2. There's also some like fun accessory items, like putting in a meal head on like certain characters in some of the screenshots that that were shown off, and then like and then more 2B Nier costumes and stuff like that. So seems like a good time. There's gonna be like new costumes, new free costumes along with the update that aren't Nier themed, so just like new costumes for Eve. They also recently announced Shift Up that the Stellar Blade is coming to PC sometime in 2025. We've already known that the PC version was in the works, but that they just like finally said, hey, it'll come sometime next year, which is not really
I'm curious. I think I might double dip on PC. I mean, I already like, you know, got through most of this game, but you know, it's like I want to double dip because
show support, you know, if you like what it's doing, definitely.
It's like this game runs extremely well on a base PS5. I'm kind of curious what the pro version runs like. People say the pro version's like, oh my, that's like night and day. But I was like,
really?
Apparently, the PS5 Pro version, one of the modes you can run at actually can, if you're on a 120 hertz display, and if you have a 120 hertz display, you have a VRR display probably. It'll actually run at 90 FPS,
okay,
instead of 60, which that's nice. Neat.
That's good. Yeah. So I'm still personally waiting for the PC version, but it's gonna be cool to see like all this content gonna be good to go when that PC version launches. I'm curious. Like I enjoyed the demo. I just didn't pick up. I didn't have time for the PS5 release, but that's already, you know.
Did they ever fix the weird input lag stuff?
Yeah, they fixed it like within like the first couple patches.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because that was the main reason I didn't pick it up at launch, is I was like, this feels terrible. And now it's like, now that the FOMO is gone, it's like, I'll just wait for a PC version.
It's cool to see them like continually like update the game, release new content and features and fixes, enhancements and stuff like that. And I believe there was some award, I forgot what the award show was, but there's like some award game awards event in Korea. And then they said like Stellar Blade pretty much sweeped like the awards up there. I forgot what it was called. It was like a random headline that's passed me by. But you know, obviously, just once again, like there's a lot of support for this game over in Korea. Shows the massive success they consider it to be, and just like their breach into like the proper full console market. That's cool to see.
This is a game that's been kind of floating around our news reel for a long while here. The title is Alaloth, Champions of the Four Kingdoms. This was first announced back in like 2017. We first covered it in 2019. It was supposed to release that year, got pushed back to 2021, released in 2022 in Early Access. It is finally releasing out of Early Access this year on November 21st. This is a CRPG isometric, kind of classically styled in the vein of like classic Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. I only know that it's based on the title and based on the press releases from earlier announcements that you align yourself with one of the four kingdoms, hence the title, which somehow affects the story. So I don't know that it set the world on fire in Early Access, but this is one of those ones where back when it was announced, like, yeah, I'll try that when it comes out. And it's coming out on November 21st. So I'm interested to see what the reception is, if it finds a fun audience that's looking for that really classic CRPG style gameplay. So it just kind of feels weird. Like it kind of felt like it disappeared and I never saw it again, and it's now releasing. It didn't get stuck in the Early Access purgatory like so many other games do. So
remind me again how the marketing department describes their game based on the first sentence of that video description.
I don't want to.
Okay, I have two things to say about this.
Yeah.
One, when we got the email about this, they're very casual about it, about like what happened with the development. And two, this is maybe a little bit more critical. They're like, we want you to review this game. Blah, 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 blah. This game is huge. We have some people with 300 hours under their belts. I'm like, that's not how you sell this game to me. Like, I mean, I don't want to.
Yeah, don't tell like, me the 300 hours. I don't want to know that.
Basically, like literally in the email that they send us to us, that they sent to us, like, we are a micro team of seven that's gone through a ton of shit because of a publisher that didn't pay us. Like, oh, okay.
Okay. Oh, dang.
A venture capitalist company that, or a venture capitalist firm that almost destroyed our company, blah, 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 blah. So, like, geez.
Well, then I didn't know that context. And then I'm extra happy for it just to get out of the Early Access purgatory. But to answer Josh's original question, long exasperated sigh. They say Baldur's Gate and Dark Souls had a baby! Exclamation point. I mean, the Baldur's Gate comparison is one of those things that's like benign. It's like, okay, it's a fantasy styled isometric RPG compared to Baldur's Gate, sure. But then like Dark Souls, like I don't see it because it has dragons and armor in it, like, what? Okay. And trying to be charitable, like, okay, maybe that's the same sort of storytelling vibe they're going for, I'm not sure. But I guess like I'm more interested than excited for this game, just because seeing something come out of such a protracted development is always kind of like, did they stick the landing, or are they just kind of like tape it up and ship it? So I mean, I'm interested.
Well, thanks to the developers, we know it's at least 300 hours long.
Yeah.
Well, not signing up for that.
If Square Enix told me, hey, FF7 Rebirth's a 100-hour game, I'd be less enthused to play that game. I'd rather find that out for myself.
Didn't they tell people that 100% playthrough would be something like that?
Yeah, nobody believed them.
Yeah, I guess whenever a developer says like, hey, our game's like 80 hours on, that I beat it like 65 to 60 hours, like whatever. Maybe it's with this game, it's like, they say it's 300 hours long, but I'll beat it like in 120 if I were to play it. Great.
Wow. God gamer efficiency right there.
Awesome.
Well, good then on Gamera Interactive. Like,
yeah, getting out of that situation for sure. Yeah. Best of luck. That's, you hate to fucking see that happen. You know, we've definitely seen some similar cases of it, like Disco Elysium, for example, and the fallout of that.
One random game that I reviewed a couple of years ago that disappeared from stores was The Outbound Ghost, a game that I didn't think was very good, but then it just kind of like got nuked from stores because of a developer publisher like issue.
Right.
And took years for that to get resolved. So good for that to still be able to be sold on Steam. A few other release dates here. Riviera, the Promised Land will launch for Switch on November 28th in the West. Let's see. I swear I talked about that not too long ago, but maybe it was something different.
Riviera came out for Steam earlier this year, and now it's on Switch in English.
Gotcha.
Yeah, like it came out on Steam like July, I believe, and that's why you remember. Like,
oh. I think the last time we talked about this game, we talked about that ugly graphic filter.
I heard you can turn that off.
Oh, they got rid of it?
I think. I might be wrong.
That's cool if they did. That'd be awesome. Yeah, I'm just seeing like the updates that it's got, like just. Maybe they got rid of it. I don't know.
Here's one from that we were wondering what happened to. Released back in March. We talked about it on the podcast way back then. The Thaumaturge will be releasing on consoles, Xbox Series, and PlayStation 5 on December 4th. In addition to that, a demo is now available on both of those stores, PlayStation and Microsoft. So kind of a very interesting game, really good voice acting, kind of a unique gameplay manner, most similarly compared to Paper Mario. But yeah, good to see. I think they announced it a while ago that it was coming to consoles, and then it went dark, and then they're saying they're getting it out before the end of the year, so releasing on December 4th.
Two thumbs up if you're interested in it. I haven't gotten it yet on console or haven't tried it yet. Definitely try out the demo on console, and if you like what you play of it, definitely I two thumbs up on the full game. I really liked it.
And now, one thing you can do now that you couldn't do before is you can play it in Polish.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yes,
I would have if I could have.
Yeah, me too. But I should definitely like do a New Game Plus playthrough and hear what the Polish voice acting.
Now, Adam, this one I was not aware of. This is the last headline we have. But when this cropped back up, you. But what year is it? Like GIF on it. This is Pantheon: Rise of the Fallen. It'll be releasing in early access on December 13th. Adam, give me some of the context here.
Okay, so Pantheon: Rise of the Fallen is an MMORPG from Brad McQuaid, who is the creator of EverQuest, and he actually created a Kickstarter campaign for this back in 2013, 2014, something like that. And it failed. And then they basically just said, well, we're going to make this game anyway. We're going to have people be able to pledge to us to basically keep this game in development. And it's been in development ever since for the last 10 years. And even in that time, Brad McQuaid has sadly passed away. But they basically said, we're going to make this. We're going to continue this. And so this game, I'm not familiar with EverQuest, but as I understand it, is meant to be like a successor to it. Or at least have some similarities, or at the very least has shared DNA because it's the same creator. So when I saw that this game is getting an early access release, like the game has been playable for people who have like pledged it, kind of like a tester, like a public beta tester, if you will. But now it's like, this is the very first version of this MMO that you can actually buy finally. So that's why I put what year is it GIF. Cause it's like, oh, I remember this game in development. I kind of just forgot it was a thing, and now here it is again. So
I kind of love, I took a look at the Steam forums for this game, and like the headlines for the Steam forums are, it's very like early to mid 2000s internet forums styled. Like you'll have like, I don't know what the threads are, but like the headlines for those threads are like amazing game, my life is ruined, too ugly to play ? Please add maps. Incredible old school MMO. It's like, oh man, it's so simple, and it's like, man, it's
dude, really I feel like I went back in time when GeoCities was still alive.
I love it. Great energy from that fucking Steam forum.
But yeah, hopefully they have success with their early access launch in mid-December. And that covers us for this week. So, Adam, thank you so much for leading the conversation on Dragon Quest III HD 2D. James on Final Fantasy XIV with Chao. And then Josh about Taiko drum sets.
Yeah.
Yep. But yeah, sounds like next week we'll be talking about Heaven Burns Red a little bit. I know we have other people that are wrapping up some other games, so we'll probably take an opportunity to look at some other games that people have gotten, you know, wrapped around to. Like I said, I had been playing Veilguard. Hopefully my computer is fixed. I know Adam's been playing Metaphor. So we'll see what comes up, and obviously if there's any news to talk about as well. So, but we finally made it through the gauntlet of new release. Well, I say that, but Heaven Burns Red is right there. So maybe we're Fantasian. Right at the tail end of it. There you go. Never mind. I take it back. It never ends. But yeah, look, check out the Dragon Quest III HD 2D review from Colin up on the site, rpgsite.net. We've also got the guides up there, the walkthroughs. We're going to kind of tweak those based on some early reception, but hopefully those will help you guys out. Join our Discord, discord.gg/rpgsite, or hit the link at the top of our homepage. You can find RPG Site on all the social media platforms, including Blue Sky. We're now there, so follow us if you haven't. If you listen to this podcast on whatever podcast service, leave us a like, leave us a rating, leave us a comment on the web post. We like to see those. We'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us then, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to y'all later.
Congrats to Brian's PC for making it all the way through. What a champ. Yep.
It didn't blow up.